are in Tempe, Arizona. This is the office of Michael Crow, who's president of Arizona State University, a job he began in July 2002. Time magazine in November 2009 named him one of the top best college presidents, and he's engaged on an adventure to build what he calls a new American university. What you did this morning, let's just make a few links here, was to open a meeting, the Education Innovation Summit, over at SkySong. How do we educate in a rapidly changing world? How do we focus information and technology to produce meaningful change? Would you first of all just integrate that into your vision of New American University and your sense, which I got from your talk, that you just think education's broken?
Well, I mean, it's really about the absence of innovation as a fundamental practice within educational institutions. In universities, particularly research universities, we have these fabulously innovative thinkers, fabulously creative scientists and humanists and social scientists. But we are antiquated in terms of our organizational structure, our linkages, our ability to work across the educational continuum. We've produced teachers for decades now that have been less than effective and not very innovative in the way the K-12 enterprise works. And so I boil it all down to not so much that we're broken, it's that we are incomplete, which will lead to the enhanced lack of success in all of our educational enterprises.
You talked about the pipeline, though, and you did use the word broken there. You gave an example, I think it was, what was it, 1 in 9 who start ninth grade? Only 1 in 9 who starts ninth grade actually finishes university. I mean, that's...
Right. So the pipeline has such heavy leakage along the way, it's definitively non-functional, that if you think about the level that American children will need to be educated to be successful economically in the future, we don't have a pipeline that's working, so let's call that broken. The brokenness, however, in my mind, is derivative not so much of bad action as much as incomplete action. This notion that somehow our institutions have become anti-innovative and unadaptive. And it's that behavior that I think sits at the root of many of our problems.
Okay, now give me a very brief sense of practically what you have done. You use this phrase about restructuring design aspirations.
Right. So what we've done within Arizona State University, a very large research-grade university, what we've done here is we've changed the aspirations. And so usually universities have an aspiration for an undefined attainment of some level of excellence. And they usually have some university that they set out as their model for their aspiration. We're saying, well, isn't that interesting? But it's very incomplete, and what does it do for us? And so what we've done is we've put forth a differentiated set of aspirations, a new aspiration relative to intellectual fusion. We will fuse disciplines every time the fusing of disciplines produces the capability for us to excite students, to tackle problems in new ways, and to produce whole new types of knowledge, particularly relative to system-level problems. We will act as a knowledge entrepreneur. That is, the university will think that its knowledge actually has the ability to have not only academic value, but also impact in the community, impact in the design of cities, impact in the design of economies or the design of new industries or whatever it happens to be. So we'll operate in both modalities. One of the design aspirations that we have is focused on social embeddedness. And so it means the university will not be distant from the communities that we serve, but will actually be embedded in every community that we link with, where we'll actually have a feedback loop relative to the knowledge that the community needs, the types of people that the community needs. It doesn't mean, as some would counter-argue, that we're abandoning our own self-determinism. It means that our self-determinism now has a purpose other than self-determinism by itself. And so in this particular case, it means designing the university to be of greater value to the society that it serves.
All right, so different theories about what the function of a university is over history, and there's no point rehearsing
right.
All of these. What is your sense of the function of a university at this point?
Well, I don't think every university has to do the same thing, so there can be different modalities of universities. So we are a knowledge enterprise. We create knowledge, store knowledge, transfer knowledge, synthesize knowledge, and we do so across a broad set of subjects. Our job is to do that in a public institution with two things in mind that private universities don't have to worry about. One, providing that knowledge enterprise set of services to the broadest demographic possible, number one. And number two, making certain that our knowledge products have the deepest impact across the broadest demographic possible. Those are things that public universities have as a unique mission, and lots of universities don't have that as their mission.
Yeah. I was reading a piece in the New York Review of Books recently by Tony Jute, I think it was, who's writing an article about, maybe it wasn't him, but there was a piece about how some of the old glory of English universities, to give a counterexample, is fading because they're cutting courses all over the place, streamlining, economizing. So the sanctuary that would have been there for scholars to ponder away a little bit, and you know, it sometimes takes time to have ideas and so on and so forth. That sanctuary is going away, and they're being turned far more into production devices.
Yeah,
do you get that kind of criticism for what you're thinking about doing?
Well, occasionally, but those are generally from people that are uninformed about our model. So the notion of sanctuary, if a part of your function is the creation of knowledge, which, as I said, it is. I don't know. In certain disciplines, that could take decades. In certain disciplines, it can take minutes. I can't judge one or the other, but the university does have to have a sanctuary-type functionality to be able to perform that knowledge creation process. Also, what we think of as a university in terms of the teaching, learning, and discovery environment is an immersive learning environment. Now, we believe that immersion learning, that is, you're involved with faculty in a teaching mode, you're involved with faculty and other students in a learning mode, and you're involved with faculty and other students in a discovery mode, that can occur on many timescales within a single individual. It can occur quickly, it can occur slowly, it can be deep, it can be shallow, it can be system level, it can be reductionist level. And what I don't buy into is this notion that there's this one way, that the Oxbridge model of the don and the faculty member spending some months together reading on a subject is the only way for a student to learn. What we've created here is we have that model in spades, and we have other models. And we have technologically enhanced learning models. We have models where we're using fast tools. We have other models where we're using deep tools. And we have classicists who are meeting with single individual students one-on-one, advancing their deep understanding of some area of the classics or whatever it happens to be. And so it's being able to be all of these things, not one of these things.
Yeah. And I want to focus too specifically on your case, because I want to get into some larger global issues. But there were a couple of things that points you made this morning that would be surprising to some people, which is my understanding was, and correct me if I'm wrong, that you don't actually have any staff unions, and you also don't have tenure?
No, we have tenure.
You have tenure,
tenure as, quite deliberately as, it is the guarantee that your ideas can be free and openly discussed, regardless of what they are, with no fear of retribution relative to your advancement of your ideas. Tenure is not a license to act poorly. It's not a license to underperform. It's not a license to not fulfill your responsibilities. It's none of those things. It is protection for you to advance any idea that you think is worth advancing. It's a powerful tool. It's a powerfully valuable tool, and it should be protected for that purpose. It's been overused and abused, and it's also the case, just relative to employment, that we have no unions of either faculty or staff at this institution, which means we have individual relationships with each and every employee.
Yeah, you made the point, a very strong point, repeated several times, about how much you set on the whole notion of individualized interactions.
Yes.
So tell me how that works with the various kind of, they're not even interdisciplinary schools, it's more like transdisciplinary schools that you've set up here, where you've got people from really disparate, what were previously thought of as disparate disciplines.
Right, so we've created
more
than 15 transdisciplinary schools, and we've said to them, for instance, when we took astronomy, astrophysics, including cosmology and geology and astrobiology and all those programs around the university, and we said, well, all of you in one way or another using various devices are scientific explorers. You explore the universe and how it works on multiple scales of time and multiple scales of smallness or largeness. We think that you have unifying sets of objectives that could allow you to work together in new and exciting ways that haven't previously been exercised. And so the faculty worked together to find a program path to form our School of Earth and Space Exploration. We did the same thing in human evolution and social change, the same thing in family and social dynamics, the same thing in the School of Sustainability, bringing together 15 or 18 disciplines to work together around, in this case, a particular outcome. The way a medical school focuses on human health, a sustainability school focuses on the collective health of the relationship of the built environment, which we control, and the natural environment, which is everywhere around us. And so in doing all of that, what we've tried to do is to facilitate new intellectual linkages. We call it intellectual fusion, where fusion produces for us differentiated, back to knowledge enterprise, differentiated knowledge outcomes. So that's what we're after.
Okay, now, that you don't have you found that you've got intellectual turf battles, turf wars that gone on? Because people don't like to be
What's interesting,
uprooted and...
Yeah, but we sort of said, you know, this is it's sort of like, well, how are you doing in your discipline all by yourself? Oh, well, maybe not everything that you'd like to do. Imagine for a second, what we've tried to empower is the notion of faculty not just as purveyor of what they know, but architect of their own intellectual destiny. And so we've tried to empower people as knowledge architects. So you tell us what would be the most exciting way that the life sciences should actually work. And so we went through this exercise where the faculty that we had in three or four different departments spread out around the university came back and said, well, in a perfect world, we would build a school of life sciences that has life scientists, engineers, ethicists, philosophers, moralists, policy analysts, lawyers, all in the same school, all thinking about where the life sciences are going. We said, fine, design it. You have 6 months. At the end of 6 months, we said, this is fantastic. Let's do it. So then we did it. And we said, now tell us where your holes are so we can fill in your intellectual gaps. And they were very excited about that. We've now doubled the number of undergraduate majors in that program, tripled the number of graduate students in that program. We now have 2,400 undergraduate life science majors. Because now there's this linkage between science and philosophy and all the big questions of life on which a scientific underpinning is really needed. And so we've attracted more students to science. We've attracted a very diverse set of students to science through this re-engineering by our faculty of the enterprise that they're a part of. They used to be a part of a department of zoology or plant biology or microbiology. Narrow fields that actually through time are actually fading in some ways as fields. Why not look at all of the life sciences together with all of the issues associated with it and build an intellectual enterprise around that? And so we've done that now more than 15 times in 15 different areas.
All right, so let's focus on education for a moment. As you know, about a month ago at the Salk Institute, the Temple Dynamics of Learning Center, we had a meeting which was an education prize advisory meeting, which you were invited to come, but I think you were wrestling with budget issues and couldn't make it. Nelson Broms, who is at this meeting of yours here, came. Michael Horn, who's also at this meeting, came. There were lots of overlaps here. The basic premise of this one, I want to get your feedback on it since you weren't there, was that it was an advisory committee to explore the potential of an incentive-driven approach to innovation in education. In other words, if you can have an X prize for landing a rocket up twice, can you have something like an education X prize? And the questions we asked were, what would constitute an ideal education that would prepare children for their future in the 21st century? What metrics could be used to determine how well they were achieving the ideal? And how could a competition be structured that would test all these different approaches and be scalable? Now, first of all, I mean, is that a sympathetic approach for you?
Yeah, it would be. I mean, incentives are powerful tools. We're underperforming in educational success dramatically. The prize should make certain that the prize is only winnable by a person that can, or an institution or a person that can demonstrate their innovation across the cross-section of society. And so that would actually be the tougher prize. So show me show me a randomly selected group of students in a public school performing in dramatically enhanced ways, both relative to international metrics of success in math and reading and so forth, but also in levels of critical thinking, entrepreneurship, creativity, and other things that we can measure. Show me universities that have very broad cross-sections of students that have very high levels of critical thinking enhancement. It's one thing to take students who are hand-selected from the upper half of a percent of high school graduates in the United States and say you've got these really smart kids that can do talented things. Well, they were really smart and really talented before you got them. And so this notion of education is difficult. Teaching is extremely challenging. And how do you innovate and how do you develop prizes and incentives that are going to enable us to have ways in which students from very broad demographics move to the capacity to be able to operate at very high levels of educational attainment and critical thinking?
Now, you're doing some of this here, obviously, because your numbers on populations that one doesn't normally think of as doing particularly well in the educational system are the subject of articles in Newsweek and Time and so on. Perhaps you could just gloss that.
Well, so we're making progress in terms of doing the following. We call it matching access with excellence. And so in the United States and in Europe, France is a good example of this. There are, let's take France, there's the La Grande École, you know, who are these elite institutions. And then there's the public universities in France who admit most high school graduates, no tuition model, low graduation rate, high dropout rate. And they're not getting the kinds of successes that they're looking for, so they have access institutions and excellence institutions. In different parts of the United States, we have the same model. We're trying to say that is a failed public policy. You need a model where you can both match access and excellence. You can have an outstanding faculty, great performers, great teachers, powerful knowledge architects, powerful knowledge creators, and you can bring a very broad cross-section of qualified students. We're not talking about admitting everyone from high school, but those that have done the right things in high school. And you bring them in, and then you're seeing the same performance across all socioeconomic groups, across all ethnic minorities. When an institution at K through 12 or universities are able to pull that off, and those students can then have access to any kind of achievement, then you'll know that innovation has occurred. Now, we're working on that. We have computer-based assistance tools. We have differentiated learning environments. We have more than one engineering school, more than one way in which you learn engineering based on your type of thinking. We have tried to create environments where we can have maximum success, and we're seeing success. We're both attracting a broader cross-section of students, and we're graduating a broader cross-section of students through those different approaches.
So that was going to be my question, which is the vision. How will you know when you've realized it? What are the metrics that would tell you that you've done
so for it? So for us, the metrics are the following. So do our faculty perform the same as the faculty at UC San Diego and UC Berkeley and Stanford and Washington and the other, you know, great universities on the West Coast? So there's ways we can measure that. That's easier to measure. So if the answer to that is yes, then let's take the student body that public universities used to admit, but don't anymore. And when our student body performs at the same level as the student body at more, or what we would call highly selective public universities and highly selective private universities, we will know we are successful because our student body will be infinitely more diverse. Our student body will come from a broader, particularly economically diverse. So already our student body has half the median income of most research-grade public universities in the country. When our performance in terms of output, what our graduates do, what they know, their critical thinking skills, their going on to graduate school, whatever it is, awards they win, all those types of things, and we're seeing huge evidence of this already. When our graduates perform equally to those graduates, then we'll know that our model has been successful. So we're measuring outputs, and we're measuring success that way.
Okay. Recently you had President Obama here.
Yes.
And you write a great deal in the journal Issues in Science and Technology. Mm-hmm. Look back over your career from Iowa State through Columbia, Executive Vice Provost there and so on. This is science and social policy is mm-hmm. something that you obviously are a preeminent expert in. So let me ask you this question then. This is the 350th anniversary year of the foundation of the Royal Society. Mm-hmm. That's the instantiation of Francis Bacon's New Atlantis, the idea of the merchants of light. In his inaugural address, That was the historic note. But in his inaugural address, President Obama said that he would like to restore science to its rightful place. Mm-hmm. Gave no coordinates. Mm-hmm. So I'm curious to know what you think, in the middle of all this, you think science's rightful place is.
Science is the most powerful sociological construct that humans have ever developed. It is the means by which we unravel and understand nature. As little as we understand it, it's infinitely more than we ever have. Science is the means by which we advance solutions to our ills and to our problems. Science is the means by which we differentiate ourselves from all other species that we know of. That is, we are knowledge-seeking, knowledge-creating creatures who use that knowledge to advance both our insight and our perspective and our well-being. When you take all of that together, when President Obama is talking about science in its rightful place, it means as a tool for enhanced understanding and social good, as opposed to a tool for politics and political agendas. And this is something that I've spent a lot of time studying and thinking about. I'm heavily influenced by a philosopher by the name of Philip Kitch, who wrote Science, Truth, and American Democracy. And Phil, when he was, who you probably know.
He's at Columbia, but he was at UC
yes,
San
right.
Diego. Right.
So he basically makes the statement that science, to have maximum impact, has to have a moral driver. And most scientists are of the view that they have a moral compass and they're doing science for the betterment of humanity through insight and perspective. But we all know that science has been abused, misguided, and not necessarily connected to enhancement of social and cultural outcomes. I'm a huge believer that if guided towards outcomes, science can be the means by which humanity advances in dramatic and powerful ways. And so I'm a huge driver for linking science with the social sciences and humanities, a huge driver for science being the means by which we determine alternative pathways as we move forward, and that science is the means by which humanity has to move forward to greater successes and greater equities. Without it, we will be where we've been in the past. Limited success, massive pain and suffering, and massive misunderstanding about who we are and where we came from and where we're going.
In your piece that you wrote called Non Dare Call It Hubris, The Limits of Knowledge, okay, you have this paragraph here, which is basically looking at the fundamental questions. How, who are we? Why are we here? How should we behave? And you said the literal answers provided by science amount to mockery. We're here because an expanding cloud of gas some 15 billion years ago eventually led to the accretion of planets, the formation of primordial nucleotides and amino acids, evolution of complex organisms, growth of complex social structures, dramatic expansion of cognitive analytical capabilities made possible by the rapid evolution of new cortical brain structures. Such explanation is entirely insufficient to promote the commonality of purpose necessary for planetary stewardship. We lack a unified or unifiable metaphysical basis for action just when we need it most.
Yes, and so what I'm talking about in that piece, which is one of my most favorite pieces that I had the opportunity to work on over a number of years, is this notion of we understand all these things and how little we still understand about how to do a simple thing like make our relationship with this natural system that we are co-evolved with and embedded in work, because we have evolved science somewhat to the extent where its overall purpose at its scale of implementation right now remains insufficiently defined. I'm a strong believer that we should have outcomes that we're working toward for which our investments in science are measured against. And so one of our outcomes, by the way, could just be fundamental understanding of nature. That's a fine outcome. Another outcome could be sustainable relationship with the planet. Another outcome could be equitable distribution of life extension healthcare technologies at reasonable and affordable costs. Those are outcomes which are easy to come up with, for which our scientific apparatus and our scientific means are not well aligned with right now. And so that paragraph or paragraphs that you were reading is a fanciful way of saying that isn't it all wonderful that we understand some of these things? Now, what are we going to do with it?
Right, but who gets to be in the driving seat and figure all this stuff out?
Yeah.
You wrote a review of somebody that I spent a lot of time thinking about, Vannevar Bush. I mean, there was a time, as you well know, when Vannevar Bush and James Conant were virtually running science policy,
right. But
kind of without oversight.
Right.
Couple of, you know, an engineer sitting there saying, this is the science, the endless frontier.
Particularly during the World War time, they had huge licenses.
Science, the endless frontier. Brilliant stuff. I mean, he comes up with Memex, which is really the precursor of the internet in some ways and so on.
Brilliant. Yeah, the article in 1945 where he conceptualized all that. Absolutely.
Right.
Yeah.
Brilliant stuff. But you had the sense that he wasn't completely in touch with what you're looking for.
No, in fact, I ran a conference, three-part conference over a two-year period at Columbia, which was a anniversary back in the mid-90s of 50 years after the Science, the Endless Frontier, and after all of Vannevar Bush's manifesto and everything. And what I was trying to get at was a critical analysis about how far we'd gotten with his very simplistic model. So his model was basically the model that had been advanced by some Europeans, Polanyi and others, this whole notion about the separation of science from society, and that what you really needed to do was to give the scientists resources and then just let them run. And that the deal would be, the social contract would be, if you give us the money, we'll give you health care, we'll give you national defense, we'll give you economic security and so forth. It's too simplistic. It's far too simplistic, because as you gradate that all down, what's happening now is you get many, many positive and negative outcomes for each scientific advance that comes along the way. Now, your question that you asked, well, who, you know, what is this then? Who's going to decide? Well, that's the more than $64,000 question. You know, we were virtually, a couple of us were virtually thrown out of the Pew Foundation a few years ago because they said, who do you guys think you are trying to come up with this new science policy model? You're not God, and we're not going to bring in some kind of God to make these decisions, so who's going to make the decisions, because the system's worked pretty well up to this point? And what our response was what we need are not huge transformations, but better education for scientists across a broader cross-section of non-scientific activities so that they can understand their roles. We need better tools, so we're working on a tool here at ASU called real-time technology assessment, where you try to think about what the impact of a scientific discovery might be if it was to evolve into a technological realm at some point in the future, so that you can start thinking about it. And then you need an understanding of how to measure outcomes against objectives. And so it's not so much the scientists, they're doing their thing and they're advancing and so forth. But for instance, let's take the billions of dollars being spent to try to defeat cancer. So metastasized cancer in the United States has not improved survivability rates, if metastasized, in 60 years. And so right now we believe that the hunt for that is just nothing more than, if you give it more money, we will eventually cure this disease. When in fact it is possible to actually go back and think, okay, what are the causalities of cancer? If cancer is killing so many people, and lung cancer, for instance, is one of the ways that so many people are dying, well, what causes lung cancer? What are the behaviors that lead to lung cancer? What research are we doing relative to those behaviors? It doesn't mean that you'd spend less on you wouldn't do molecular related research, but it does mean you'd have a differentiated research agenda if in fact your actual objective was to have higher efficacy rates of success in certain cancers. And so that kind of logic and those kinds of tools are things that could be very useful at places like the NIH and other places. And they, for the most part, aren't being applied.
But if you had to apply that, so what would you do with education then? So, I mean, suppose I said you're Arne Duncan and you can do whatever you... How would you retool the educational system?
I would turn it all into an outcome-oriented enterprise and focus only on... I'd set the outcomes that you want to achieve. What levels of educational achievement would you like to attain? How would you like those educational attainment levels to be distributed across the society? And I'd start measuring everyone against that. Who is making success? Who is having success relative to those attainment objectives? And so if we want every kid at the sort of math level... If we want every high school graduate to be fluent in algebra at the second level and fundamental and have a fundamental understanding of pre-calculus, how will we measure it? How will we measure it against everyone? So I'd make it into an outcome-oriented, measurement-oriented enterprise, and all innovations, all investments, all research would be linked to their contribution to that.
So, but how did you get into this business in the first place? I mean, is there a family history of science?
No, my dad was an enlisted man in the Navy. I didn't come from a scientific family, but I was deeply affected by an event on Christmas Eve of 1968 when I was doing my Eagle Scout service project, and another guy and I and our troop had raised money and collected food for two families to supply them with all the food they needed for a year and toys for their families and everything. So it was a big deal, huge amounts of stuff and a big logistic thing. And so we got the names from the county social welfare office in southern Maryland, where I was living at the time. And on Christmas Eve, my dad and I and others had these U-Haul trucks, and we went to these families, and we're going to deliver all this stuff. And my father was working class, but I'd never been around really poor families. So we went back into the woods in Maryland, and these were former sharecroppers living on former sharecropper property, living in a shack with a dirt floor and an outhouse and a potbelly stove. And so we had this fabulous experience with the family, and I remember vividly in my mind coming back, and that night, Apollo 8 was circling the moon for the first time. Humans were circling the moon, and I thought, even to myself as a 13-year-old boy, at the time I thought, something is screwed up. Screwed up big time. We're doing this one thing and we've still got this other problem. And how can we live in so many, I said to myself, I called it time zones, I meant periods. How can we live in so many time periods at the same time? And so what I started to become interested in then as a teenager was this notion about science as this unbelievable driver of achievement, but all of the sort of inability to translate that into equitable success across our whole society. And so I wasn't very sophisticated then. And by the time I went to college, a few years later, I started studying science, engineering, and social science as an undergraduate. Then I got involved in projects that were linked to that. And then I found a graduate school that had a program in that. And I went to that. So I started reading more and understanding more and doing more projects. I was also what was called a VISTA volunteer, a volunteer in service to America, in a program called University Year for Action, where you get pulled out of college for 1 or 2 years. And you work on social issues. And so I was in the field working on these social issues, but my assignment was related to energy projects in an area in Iowa and Missouri that had coal fields in it. And it was, how could you convert these coal assets into economic assets, into energy assets to reduce energy independence or energy dependence, yeah, and then help the local farmers and everybody else. And so I became involved in this project. And so it was sort of that combination of all those things that got me thinking that here we have this unbelievable tool that since the Enlightenment has been driving our understanding and our perspective forward and our tools and our means and so forth. But we still have this huge gap. And so that's what drove me into being interested in it, was that Christmas of 1968.
Yeah. So in terms of this adventure that you're on with the New American University, I mean, have you set a time limit on this?
We thought 10 years. I've been at it 8 years. 10 years to get the first phase done, that is to reorient and re-genetically engineer the institution at sufficiently large enough of a scale that we're set, and then to move the institution forward to this access and excellence goal. And so, we think that we're ahead of our goals relative to the first 10 years. And then when we hit that mark, then we'll look at what you can do now that we have this differentiated institution. Now, we're already seeing unbelievable signs of progress in terms of who's coming, who's graduating, how successful they are, the kinds of research programs and discovery programs that we've gotten launched. And so we're very excited about all that.
In this economy, are you...
Economies are temporary things. People that spend a lot of time worrying about the ups and downs of the economy, they don't understand curved lines. And so the curve is still up, dramatically up, and has been up for a long time. Take advantage of the curve. When you have a down moment on a curved line that has an upward slope, use it to your advantage to do the hard things that you need to do.
Do you have any other senses of areas where you want to produce more of these transdisciplinary enterprises? I mean,
we need to do a lot more within the humanities and linking the humanities with the sciences. We're working heavily in a whole new construct set that we have in engineering. We eliminated all the disciplines in engineering, all the departments, and now we have theme-based, grand challenge-oriented schools, so we're working hard on those.
What about education schools?
Education, we took our traditional structure and just dismantled it. We're reconstructing from the ground up. We're focusing on...
This is your school of education,
yes, redesigning who we select as teacher candidates, redesigning how they're educated, redesigning how we work with them as they move out, all those things.
At this meeting that we did in at Salk, one of the things that I produced was a little packet which showed the latest stories in the mainstream media about the whole education crisis. One was a New York Times cover story, New York Times magazine, about building better teachers.
Right.
The other one was a cover of Newsweek, which said, fire all the bad teachers.
Right.
Third one was a piece in The Atlantic by Amanda Ripley, who has right. also got the cover of Time magazine
this week about
incentives. Yeah. All about teachers yes. until this last one. And my question was, building a better teacher is obviously a good idea.
Yeah.
How do you build a better student?
Well, you build a better student by selecting the right person. You're talking about once the teacher's with the student or us. So for us, it's about picking the right person to be a teacher. And then when that teacher, that new kind of teacher that we're working very hard to produce, is then engaged with the students, the student is empowered through technology, empowered through grand challenges, empowered through problem solving, empowered through problem-based learning. It's all those things and bringing all those things to bear. That's how we think we're going to move forward.
But it's also the neuroscience underpinning, I would argue, in the sense that there's the understanding, the cognitive architecture and the dynamics of the learning process as well. And until we understand all of that.
Well, we need a much deeper understanding of all of that than we have, and we need to then feed that into the way that we design the learning environment.
Yeah. Do you, one of the questions I ask people a lot is, do you have any advice to a young scientist?
Don't focus only on your science, focus intensely on your science and understand how and why it might be used and engage in K-12 educational initiatives.
Yeah. As you got into this business, you've obviously read a lot of history of science as well. Another question I do like to ask people is, you have free access now. You can do your time zones thing, time travel. Who would you like to have to dinner?
Oh, to dinner.
It's the dinner party question. Anybody that entranced you as you were learning all about the history of this business?
Yeah, I mean, lots of people. I think Copernicus, for whatever reason, and other courageous scientists during the time of the church having such control over where knowledge was going were always fascinating to me as to how courageous they were and others of that era. And so it struck me as always interesting to think about those kinds of scientists. I think individuals who were great synthesizers, probably Oppenheimer was not a synthesizer, but I'd like to ask him why it was that he thought that somehow he was surprised by the technology that he helped to develop, and now we're still living with the consequences of that development. You know, why it was that there was little thought given to, once this knowledge was moving forward, how it might ultimately be used.
Now, this is an area, nuclear power and so on, that you actually do have some people here who know something about
yes.
at ASU, right? So
yes.
Is this something that you're going to be...
We're going to be looking a lot at military technologies and other types of technologies and where they're going and how technologies move forward. And so we're looking a lot at future technologies and where they're headed.
Yeah, is George Post involved in this?
He's involved with it, Joel Garreau and others. So.
One of the other pieces you wrote in Issues in Science and Technology, almost close to the end paragraph here where you're talking about the Obama administration again. You said the success of President Obama's new science team should be measured by its ability to break down the historical disconnect between science and policy. Our scientific enterprise excels at creating knowledge, but it continues to embrace the myth that new knowledge emerging from the stubbornly disciplinary channels of today's scientific programs automatically and serendipitously turns into social benefit.
Yeah, that's the Vannevar Bush model, which is the model of a simplistic first-generation creative thinker. So he's a very creative thinker, fantastically successful 70 years ago. We need newer and better ideas. We need to know what our investments are for. So right now, the basic arguments in Washington are the following. If you give more money to science, good things will happen. That's the extent of the argument. Yeah. That is a child's argument. And so what we need are... If you invest here, we can produce these particular outcomes. If we have this kind of level of understanding and excitement about, you know, cosmology, we'll produce these kinds of outcomes and these kinds of things. And so this is a call for enhancement of our decision-making models.
Have you ever, is this something you'd ever want to get into, actually being in politics? Do you think there ought to be more scientifically trained people in the political system?
Well, I'm definitely a believer that there needs to be as much expertise in the political system as possible.
Would you ever think of running for office?
No, I sort of am a politician in this job right now, but so I haven't thought about that.
All right. So one thing I wanted to close on here, the Royal Society's 350th anniversary year, I just wanted to tell you what they're achieving, five strategic priorities. I'd just like to get your comment on that. One is to invest in future scientific leaders and innovation. Two, influence policymaking with the best scientific advice. Three, invigorate science and mathematics education. Four, increase access to the best science internationally. And five, inspire an interest in the joy, wonder, and excitement of scientific discovery.
So what's interesting is that number five, the last one, is in conflict with the other four that they put on the table to some extent, and they might not see it. And so one of the reasons that we have such difficulty in getting kids to understand math and science is that the teachers become further and further disempowered to be able to excite students. They're just not able to use. Students want to know why. If you're not naturally attracted to science, everybody else, which is most everyone else, needs to understand what the problem is about. Why are we learning this? Why are we learning calculus? And so the reason that we have such difficulty in the university is that we haven't yet found a way for groups as sophisticated as the Royal Society to step outside of the box of the scientific thinker and think inside the box of everyone else. So as the gap between scientific knowledge and fundamental layperson understanding grows wider and wider and wider over time, except through efforts, you know, of outreach and education, this ability to understand how to translate between the two is not keeping up with things. And so my overall reaction to these is that, you know, they are what you would expect. They are about what scientists think other people need to know about them and what they're doing.
In the book called The Canon, Natalie Angier talks about how a discussion she had with Peter Galison, the historian of science, and they're bemoaning the fact that somehow you get these bright little objects called children that are full of energy and full of excitement, and somehow knock it all out of them by the time they're...
Absolutely. By the end of the fourth grade.
You start with them in museums, and they play with sticky objects.
Absolutely.
And at the age of 12, they're given a card to the Museum of Contemporary Art, and that's it, and they're lost. How do you fix that? I mean, I actually...
What we're focused on is challenges. You create things that are exciting. People that want to build a sustainable world, people that want to do this or this, you have to attract the person to the learning environment by the challenge of the problem. The math tool, the science tool, the engineering tool, whatever it is, that's the means to solve the problem. The students are attracted to the problems. We know that. We can see that in spades here. So the barrier then, the math and the science and the technology learning then is accelerated because it's the means by which that problem can be addressed. We're seeing this in our School of Sustainability. We're seeing this in other things that we're doing at the university.
Is there anything else that you'd ever have considered doing other than this? I mean, any other thing?
You know, I've been in college for over 30 years, and so going to college for 30...
Are you a frustrated poet, musician, or...?
No. I am. I view myself as an architect. And so architects are always challenged by the next design problem. So for me, it's always the larger design problem that I'm attracted to.
Well, last thing, what are you optimistic about?
Optimistic? I'm optimistic about this future generation. They're unbelievably connected, synthesized thinkers. They think across disciplines. They think in new ways. Every day that I'm encountering these kids that are coming to the university, graduate students, undergraduate students, my optimism about the future just accelerates.
Good. Michael Crowe, thanks very much.
Thank you.